From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mission District.
Fremont.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Temescal.
Tenderloin.
Treasure Island.
Richmond, California.
Coming up, high-speed rail is on the fast track again, or is it?
By the time the project's finished, even on the most optimistic standards, Jerry Brown will probably be, passed away.
Then we'll hear about the latest federal crackdowns on the medical marijuana industry.
Not only is the administration depriving these communities of millions of dollars in tax revenue, they're putting people out of work. They're depriving people access to what is supposed to be legal medicine.
And we'll learn about the formalization of the Occupy movement.
The primary problem is that we are just this commodity. We're supposed to work, we're supposed to make money, and we're supposed to buy things. And we're all disposable, and our real nature doesn't really matter.
We've got stories that matter to the Bay Area coming up on Cross Currents. The bullet train may be back on track. Earlier this month, the state legislature narrowly approved $8 billion in bond money to start the construction of the high-speed rail system connecting Los Angeles to the Bay Area. Governor Jerry Brown signed off at ceremonies in L.A. and San Francisco.
What this is all about is investing in the future. I know there are some fearful men, I call them decliners, who want to put their head in a hole and hope reality changes. I don't see it that way. This is a time to invest, to create thousands of jobs like this project. We had the Golden Gate Bridge in the middle of the Depression. So it isn't, when things aren't going so good, it's not a time to kind of hunker down and hope that it all blows over. You have to take the bull by the horns and start spending and investing in things that make sense. That's why we're here today. You put people to work.
The project is now expected to cost close to $69 billion to complete. The bulk of the money the legislature just approved will go to start building a 130-mile stretch of track in the Central Valley. About a quarter will go to local transportation projects in L.A. and San Francisco. The bullet train project is controversial. The scope and the price tag has changed many times since voters first approved the plan back in 2008. And the project now faces multiple lawsuits designed to stop construction before it starts. KLW's transportation reporter Julie Kane sat down with Michael Rosenberg, a reporter who covers high-speed rail for the San Jose Mercury News.
It's interesting that the building is starting in the Central Valley, where there is a lot of opposition, very vocal opposition to the project, and in fact, a lot of litigation. I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the real obstacles, particularly legal obstacles that are in the way of the bullet train now.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the Central Valley was supposed to be the easy part because the opposition was really in the Bay Area and just so many people in L.A. that they would have to displace. But the Central Valley, they were supposed to, just sort of say, yeah, this is great, come on down. And it turns out they were the ones who rose up against it the fiercest. And now they're really only faced with one option, which is to sue, because no one has any control over the project outside of the state and the federal government. So if you're a local county or city or a farmer or a business owner, the only thing you can do is just try to sue. And so there's, about a half a dozen suits going on right now. There's going to be more coming. But the general idea is to have a judge issue an injunction to stop them from being able to start construction. And that's something that will be playing out over the next 6 months or so.
And I know there are also some questions about whether it's actually legal in terms of what the voters voted on in 2008, because the high-speed rail plan has changed so much since that time.
Right. It's an ethical argument that we voted on a certain plan. It was supposed to be $33 billion. Now it's twice that. It was supposed to open by 2020. Now it's 2030. The ticket to get from SF to LA was supposed to be $55. Now it's like $85. The rider estimates have gone in half. Everything has changed pretty dramatically, but some of the opponents are trying to use that sort of going beyond just sort of an ethical argument and saying, well, it's just flat out illegal. You can't use this money. It's a legal statute that was created when the voters passed the bond measure to approve the project in 2008. So if you're going to use that money, you have to adhere by what you said you were going to spend the money on. So That's probably not an argument that's going to win in a legal sense, because they usually give them sort of leeway to spend money on those sorts of things if the details have changed. But just from an ethical standpoint, that's sort of the main argument that opponent's sight when you're talking about people who once supported it and are now against it.
In light of all of that, why is Jerry Brown still such a champion of high-speed rail? Why is he still so behind it?
Well, there's a couple of schools of thought on that. I mean, what he says is that he dreams of doing big things, and he doesn't believe that bad times are the time to shy away. I mean, he had this press conference where he called all the skeptics, fearful men and NIMBYs and declinists, and he tends to sort of take his point of view and it doesn't necessarily care so much about what the polls say, especially when it comes to a long-term project that really, I mean, to be frank, I mean, by the time the project's finished, even on the most optimistic standards, Jerry Brown will probably be, passed away. So it's something that's so long-term, he'll never really have to deal with the repercussions of it. And, from a skeptic standpoint, what people point to is that the main driver of this project in terms of the funding to get the ballot measure passed, to keep it going, and to lobby politicians has come from the construction unions, because, of course, that $69 billion, that's going into their pockets. So the Democrats, Brown, and some of the others are funded mostly by the unions. So if they turn down a project that the unions support, then they risk losing the support of their major funding backers, and then they might not get elected back to office.
Mike Rosenberg is a reporter with the San Jose Mercury News. He spoke with KALW's transportation reporter, Julie Kane. And you can follow her coverage of high-speed rail and other transportation issues at transportationnation.org and KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. California's bullet train is important not only to Governor Brown, but also to President Barack Obama.
We're at the mercy of fluctuating gas prices all too often. We pump too many greenhouse gases into the air. What we need then is a smart transportation system equal to the needs of the 21st century. A system that reduces travel times and increases mobility. A system that reduces congestion and boosts productivity. A system that reduces destructive emissions and creates jobs. What we're talking about is a vision for high-speed rail in America.
The president made a campaign stop in Oakland earlier this week. And while he received a warm reception inside the Fox Theater, outside hundreds of demonstrators protested. One of the main talking points? Federal crackdowns on medical marijuana clinics. Carolyn Hamilton, who works in the industry supply chain, said Barack Obama has done more damage during his time in office than the Bush administration did in 8 years.
This is our livelihood, as it is for a lot of people, and by shutting us down, by shutting down legal businesses, not only is the administration depriving these communities of millions of dollars in tax revenue, they're putting people out of work. They're depriving people access to what is supposed to be legal medicine.
KLW's Stephen Short tracks issues in the cannabis community, and he joins me now for an update. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Holly. Well, the biggest news this week, it actually happened yesterday, the Los Angeles City Council, the second largest city in the country, voted to ban all dispensaries. Now, these are storefront dispensaries.
So that's in L.A. How does that affect us here in the Bay Area?
Well, because it's the L.A. City Council, it won't directly impact us. But it's certainly a shock to the industry, which is already under stress. And, of course, there will be thousands of people who will lose their jobs, who are working in these fields. The patients are going to be in turmoil, that kind of thing. But it won't be a direct impact on us.
And you mentioned that the industry is under stress, and that's because of this federal crackdown on cannabis in California. Monday, President Obama visited Oakland, and he was met there by cannabis activists, legalization activists, who were protesting what's happening with Harborside Health Center. Can you tell us what's new on that?
Well, other than the protest, which ended up having, perhaps 1,000 people show up, this is just kind of in process now. The newest thing, which many of our listeners, I think, know, is that Melinda Haig, the U.S. Attorney for Northern California, filed a forfeiture lawsuit. Now, that's supposed to be a little bit different. you remember the banks being considered too large to fail, too big to fail a while ago. She's saying that Harborside is too big to be safe.
So what does that mean?
Well, here's a quote from the statement announcing the lawsuit. The larger the operation, the greater the likelihood that there will be abuse of the state's medical marijuana laws. Now, let me just say, again, this says that there's a likelihood, there's a possibility. And that's why this march we just heard about was planned on Monday. Pro-dispensary people say there's no advantage to continuing the drug war, and it's a waste of scarce resources. We know all that. In fact, closing dispensaries will just push more people into the street unregulated and untaxed arena. So why do this? Why close these things?
So that's what advocates are saying. What is the government saying?
Well, the White House and the U.S. Attorney's Office did not comment on the demonstrations. So to continue with the too big analogy, I guess these offices are just too big to have to explain.
And so where does it stand now with Harborside?
Well, with Harborside, like many of the dispensaries, it's always known that it could very possibly be shut down. You'll remember, last month that we aired a profile on Steve D'Angelo, the co-founder of Harborside, and he said as much.
I've never known when I come to work in the morning whether I'm going to go home at night or whether I'm going to be taken away in handcuffs.
Harborside, of course, vows to stay open and to fight the crackdown. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm speaking with KALW's Stephen Short about the marijuana wars, essentially. Last time you did a report for us, Stephen, you reported that credit card processors had said that they wouldn't deal with dispensaries any longer.
Right, right. Well, that was actually the credit card processing unit. They said, but it's the same idea. Visa and MasterCard would not take... They just wouldn't process their transactions anymore. Well, that has escalated some. Now the banks are also going further with that. Citibank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Chase say that they are no longer allowing the dispensaries to have deposit accounts. So that means not only do the patients have to come in with bundles of cash, once that money is in the dispensaries have nowhere to put it because the banks won't accept it.
That seems like a public safety concern, that would be rife for robbery or something.
Well, I think, yes, it could well be. But, I mean, the whole a cannabis dispensary like a liquor store is a good place to steal in the first place. But it's just, yes, it's going to impact that more directly. Now, the Wells Fargo statement kind of nicely sums up their thinking here. That said, in part, in view of the complex, inconsistent legal environment relating to medical marijuana dispensaries, Wells Fargo Regional Banking has opted not to bank these businesses. So they also realize that all these regulations are a mess right now. You have cities in you have the city council in Los Angeles banning things. You have the state saying another thing. Then you have the federal government coming in and saying something else. The banks, I think, are making enough headlines with dirty money already without getting any further into it. So you can see why they would want to back off of this, too.
That's KALW's Stephen Short. He's a reporter with KALW News, and he's been covering the legalization debate over marijuana. You can catch all of his reporting and his blogs at KALW.org. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The Oakland Obama protests included some self-identified members of Occupy. That movement, which began gathering national attention last September, has diminished in terms of outside rallies, but there are still a lot of people challenging economic disparities in their own ways. For example, Bay Area residents gather in San Francisco Monday nights to brainstorm solutions to issues like health care, gentrification, and unemployment. The events are called Occupy Forums. KALW's Fatima Duran sat in one night when the topic was jobs and how to make our work more meaningful.
Did anyone ever ask you this question when you were a kid?
What do you want to be when you grow up?
That's an organizer for Occupy San Francisco, who goes by the name of Magic. But while she's asking the question, she doesn't believe it really matters anymore.
We are just this commodity. We're supposed to work, we're supposed to make money, and we're supposed to buy things, and we're all disposable, and our real nature doesn't really matter.
While Magic thinks that's how things are, she doesn't think that's how it needs to be. and neither did about 80 people who joined her at the Women's Building in San Francisco on a recent Monday night. At an Occupy forum, they explored the topic of work and whether or not our jobs contribute something to society. The event included a lecture by guest speaker and Critical Mass founder Chris Carlson, who drew a contrast between the work that gives us money and that which we find meaningful.
Over the last 10 or 15 years, you see people coming together in projects that take place outside of their paid jobs, which are mostly a waste of time anyway, and they shouldn't bother, but they need to make money, so they go. But when they're not at their dumb jobs, they're actually working very hard, and they're creating alternatives based on their full existence as human beings.
Carlson has a critical viewpoint, and while he and other participants in the forum may feel dissatisfied with the concept of what constitutes work these days, that sentiment is not necessarily universal. A survey conducted in 2011 by the Nielsen Company shows 47% of employees in the U.S. are not satisfied with their work. That's actually better than it was a year earlier. But generally, job satisfaction has been declining over the last quarter century, particularly among older generations, perhaps because the economic downturn has forced them to postpone their retirement. For Carlson, the Occupy movement has given voice to frustrated workers.
I mean, that's finally what most of us here are interested in, is the best life that everybody can have all together on the planet with the least damage to the ecology and the most pleasure for all of us.
After Carlson spoke, there were small group discussions. Magic facilitated a conversation of about 10 people. She asked what kind of profession they would feel happy in if they weren't bound by fears of not having health care or accumulating debt.
We were really trying to see how we could model in public places a sense of a commonality and common purpose in situations that did not have hierarchy, did not have money exchange, and were ecologically sound, fun, creative. So we thought of things like reuse and repair, so that we're not throwing things away, swaps and exchanges of goods, having free education in the commons, shared, like we'd have one laundromat for a neighborhood, we'd have a tool library that's free.
The groups then gathered to address the whole assembly.
So people can move the chairs back to...
Like Magic's group, many suggested lending programs to address the issue of consumerism. Chris Carlson shared other concrete examples.
I've seen it already in the bicycling culture with Critical Mass and DIY bike shops, you know, the whole community gardening movement, biofuels, you know, co-ops, all kinds of efforts that people have been making for quite a long time now over the last 10 or 15 years.
Other people who attended the event said at times the solutions they heard sounded naive. One person said, if everybody did whatever they wanted, it would probably lead to a lot of crappy artwork. That raised a larger question. If everyone had their dream profession, who would do the jobs people didn't want to do? A tough question. But as Magic pointed out, this was just the first Occupy forum on the subject.
What I think was really great about tonight is that for the first time that I've been in a public discussion, there was a sense that nobody was trying to win a point and win over somebody and lecture and be in charge, that there was a real sense of both and I agree with what you're saying, and I think that's possible, and that's not mutually exclusive, and to me, that's a brilliant step in the right direction.
With the Occupy movement dissipating over time and protesters displaced repeatedly, this gathering gave a sense of place and community. Those who attended were hopeful about developing their own remedies rather than accepting the prescribed status quo. In San Francisco, I am Fatima Duran for Cross Currents.
Occupy forums take place in San Francisco Monday nights at 6 p.m. at the Women's Building on 18th Street. The next topic is living on the streets with Occupy. For more information, go to kalw.org. And if you want to let us know how you feel about the Occupy protests, go to our Facebook page. We're KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan.
The Bay Area is known for its creativity and its critical thinkers, activists, free spirits, soul searchers, and innovators. At CrossCurrents, we've been discovering some of these voices through our community storytelling initiative, Hear Here, a pop-up radio project. Our Hear Here producers recently popped up at the Ortega branch of the San Francisco Public Library. There, they asked residents of the Outer Sunset District for their personal stories on food. They met bakers, barbecue owners, and one young woman whose story of food, family, and the search for happiness spanned the Pacific Ocean. This is her story.
Here. Here.
Here.
Okay, together. Okay.
Here, here.
A pop-up radio project.
From KALW.
My name is Xiao Juan Shu. I grew up in northern Jiangsu province. It's on the east coast of China, and I went to college in Nanjing. Then I came to America. You know, I used to work a big job at one of the big four accounting firms as like hedge fund auditor. And I thought that was my American dream, you know, work for a big company and start making more money and help my family in China. But something's missing, like I don't feel fulfilled. Something's missing, and I couldn't figure out what was that. Every night when I came to my apartment, I feel so tired. And then I will miss my mother's, you know, the fish soup I used to hate so much. My mama always, you know, burn incense to pray to the Buddha. She said, you know, may my kids or get high score in school, because that's the only way her kids can, you know, get education and be respected by others. Not like her in the countryside, nobody respects her as a peasant. You know, she wasn't educated and everything. When she was like 11 years old, my grandpa asked her to quit school to support the family because she was the oldest daughter. And my father was sick when we were like, you know, very young teenager. So she was the single breadwinner to support two kids to go to college as a peasant in China. She always cooked, you know, the best she could, even though she didn't have money. Fish soup and rice with pig fat and fried rice with eggs. She just made me sit there, and then she will, from the kitchen, she will just bring out one after one dishes on the table, and just, and if she comes back and the previous dish is not gone down, you know, to the degree she likes, she will be upset. But I used to hate her cooking because it's just nothing fancy. Especially after I go to college, I've seen so many things, and everything at home looked more backward. One time she was so happy, she said, she went to the market that morning and got the fish, fresh fish alive, and she was very happy to cook that for me. And she got it from the kitchen to say, hey, you would like this one, this fish soup. And it was white, and she was very proud of what she did. And I turned around, I saw her thumb was dipped into the soup because the soup was so full, she wanted me to drink to have more soup. So I was really mad. I said, Mom, look, your dirty thumbs are dipped in the soup, you know. And so I kind of yelled at her. I feel like I wasn't mature and I wasn't big enough to accept who she was and to accept who I am. I was ashamed, you know, to have a mom like, you know, a peasant. I never wanted her to come to my school. But when I think about it, I think she represents the power of China, 1.3 billion people, 1 billion in the countryside. But they are faceless people, nobody cares. They're always the one sentence in any article, yeah, the peasants in the countryside. But I think I'm more respectful of who she is. You know, I'm the only one in my family came to America, you know, earn a degree, find a big job. But I can't stop finding the true happiness for myself. And I want my my mother's effort make it worth, because even though if I make money, but if I'm not happy, I think that she doesn't want to see that.
That's San Anselmo resident Xiao Jin Xu. She spoke with Erica Mu for our new community storytelling initiative, Hear Hear, a pop-up radio project. To meet more of your neighbors and find out how to participate in Hear Hear, go to our website. We're klw.org. That's also where you'll find a link to all of the Hear Hear stories and how you can subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Buffy Almendares, Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Lupe Hernandez, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Taja Lanier, Holly J. McDeed, Erica Mu, Stephen Short, and Isaac Silk. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor, and it's also her birthday today. Happy birthday.
I am Masher Casey, known after the May 2nd victory as Catcher Masher Casey.
Martina Castro is our managing editor, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Car Share is on the web at citycarshare.org. And especially thanks to you. Cross Currents is listener-supported radio. Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. With the upcoming Olympics, we'll play some ping pong or table tennis.
I mean, it's so hard to describe, like, this feeling of complete joy and happiness. Like, I don't know, it just hasn't really, like, it's sunk in, but it's just like, I can't believe it. Like, I'm going to Olympics, and it just feels so amazing.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The music you're hearing is being played by The Bachelors, a band from San Francisco. They're playing next Monday and nearly every Monday at the Saloon in San Francisco's North Beach. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.